Okay, so what is the finished work and who does it apply to? I like what you were saying about, you know, in Hebrews 4:3, God is angry if we don't enter into the rest of the finished work. That's very good. Anybody else? Why would God be angry if we didn't enter into the rest of the finished work? Does God get angry because I don't think His blood was good enough? What if I'm a believer who is perhaps in a weakened state? Not necessarily even weak, but in a weakened state. Let's say maybe my health is very bad, perhaps, and that weakens me spiritually. Or maybe I'm facing things that are overwhelming to me and that weakens me. That's what happened to Jesus, right? After 40 days of fasting, he was in a weakened state. And so Satan tried to take advantage. What if I'm a believer who's in a weakened state and I have trouble believing the finished work? If you haven't been there yet, you will be. Okay? But what about, does God get angry at that? Isn't a lack of trusting the finished work really operating outside of faith? Whatsoever is not of faith is sin. How does sin work then? Like, what is my relationship to sin? Let's say that I have an illness. Okay? And it's questionable as to whether I'll survive. And there are many people in that position, okay? And maybe God will heal me, maybe the doctors will heal me, but maybe not. And I don't know, okay? And I have perhaps trouble, maybe the longevity of the illness, I have trouble trusting completely that the work is finished and that God, you know, or that God will come through or something like that. Is that a lack of faith? Well, yeah, in some aspects it is, but we have to be very careful when we tread on those grounds. Okay, because we're dealing with far more than what may seem superficially to be there. Okay, yeah, in a sense, like I have trouble trusting the finished work. Yes, this is, I don't have the capacity to have faith in that area. Okay, but does that make God angry? No, it doesn't. Why not? Because our sins are removed as far as the east is from the west. When does the removal of my sin come? Before I sinned. Okay? From the foundation of the world, the works were finished. Right? Hebrews 4:3. That means that the world was established in the finished work. Okay, that's what it's saying. The world was established in the finished work. So, when is God going to be angry at the believer? Never. He will not face God's anger. God cannot be angry with him because the believer has imputed righteousness. And what is there then to be angry about? When the blood is shed, the sin is removed. Okay? When the blood is shed, the sin is removed. And so, even though I may sin, the sin will never be imputed to me because it's removed. The reason why anyone is disciplined for sin is not because of the sin, but because of the lack of fellowship with God at that point. Right? That separation factor. This is why people are disciplined. Okay? It's not for the sin. The sin has been taken care of. God is not a God of double jeopardy. The sin has been taken care of. So if a believer is chastised for sin, it's not because of the sin, but because of the separation that the sin has caused. And the chastisement does not come out of punishment, but rather out of an attempt at reconciliation. Right? We all know that. Right? We've all learned that. And so, when the finished work is doubted, the person is experiencing a lack of faith in their life, but that sin aspect of that lack of faith has been removed. That's something we have to understand. The sin aspect has been removed. The sin aspect of everything has been removed. So anger will never come to the believer for sin. Anger will never come to the believer for anything. So, what was my original question? Does anybody remember? Okay, so yeah, so what is the what is the finished work, right? What is the how do I relate to it, and what is it? Why does it make God angry that a believer won't enter into the finished work? It's not the sin component, because that's been dealt with. Think about this. Why wouldn't God be angry? Because love seeks not its own. Right? Love doesn't seek its own. Love suffers long. It's very patient. It suffers long. It endures for a great long time. And it doesn't seek its own. Alright? Now, people might get angry. But God would not hear. But there is something there that causes His anger. Anybody know? Well, there's really only one recipient of God's anger. There was one, and there is one. The other kingdom. The other kingdom. Why is God angry? Because the person who is not resting in the finished work, in some aspect of their lives, is being either influenced or somehow manipulated by, or perhaps even in some cases possibly even serving the other kingdom. When we give no place to the devil, we rest in the finished work. That's how we give no place to the devil. Because the throne of iniquity works mischief by the law, right? The opposite of the finished work is some form of law, be it Mosaic law or be it a self-defined law, but some form of a production. And often people who suffer a great deal will then start to blame themselves. And they say, well, it's my fault for this, or perhaps I should be more like this, or they'll even blame themselves for not being able to rest in the finished work. But that's not how God sees things. The way that God sees things is that there is a rest for the people of God. Right? That's how God sees things. And in the times that I'm not able to continue, what does He say? Take my yoke upon you and learn of me. Right? All you that are weak and heavy laden, take my yoke upon you and learn of me. For I am meek and lowly in heart. For I am meek and lowly in heart. Okay, so what happens that if I'm overwhelmed and tired? Does God get mad at me for not trusting Him? No. God is saying, if you're overwhelmed to the point where you don't trust me, then learn who I am. He doesn't say, start trusting me. That's a useless statement. He doesn't say, start trusting me. He says, learn who I am. That's where I can start trusting Him, when I learn who He is. The reason why I don't trust Him in various areas of my life, and every one of us has that. Every one of us can come to the point, and every one of us eventually will come to the point, where trusting God is a challenge. And at that point, when one of those forks, right, you either choose for God or you choose for something else. But you're going to have to choose. Okay? When I get to that point where I'm like, I don't know that I can trust you, God. God doesn't say, well, just trust me anyway. God says, then learn of me. Get to know who I am, and then you'll trust me. So if I have an area where it's difficult for me to trust, it's an area where I don't know Him yet. Now, why does He bring me to the point where it's difficult for me to trust? And what will be the result of that? He's taking care of those areas. In other words, God knows exactly how much I know Him and what I know of Him. And in one by one, and this will happen multiple times in your lives. It's happened in my life. It's happened in the life of every believer who continues with God. One by one, areas of my life where I have difficulty trusting Him will be addressed because I don't know Him in that area. And so He won't say, trust me. What He'll do is He'll address the real issue. The issue isn't that I don't trust Him. The issue is that I don't know Him. Not in that area. It's like my friend Tony said to Pastor Stevens when he was when he had cancer and he was, you know, just a short time before he died. Pastor Stevens went to visit him in the hospice and, you know, he asked him, you know, how are you? And not just, that wasn't the superficial, how you doing? Right? And Tony said to him, Pastor, I'm getting to know God in this area. And getting to know God. That was a tremendous confession. That was a tremendous confession. Why? Because that area of his life, Tony didn't know Him yet. But he was getting to know Him. Likewise, when I get into a circumstance that is bigger than I am, and I say, I don't know that I can trust You here, God. That's actually an incorrect statement. The correct statement is, I don't really know You here yet, God. I don't know who You are in this particular area of my life. And God says, okay, let's take You there. Let's take You there so You can learn of Me. Why does God allow the believer to become overwhelmed? Because a believer who's not overwhelmed is a believer who's not going to be weak. Now, that's not going to be a place where I am all the time. But a believer who's not overwhelmed is a believer who's not going to be weak. Well, how am I going to learn God's strength unless I have weakness? Right? The perfection of God is made perfect in my imperfection. Okay, the strength of God is made perfect in my weakness. The mercy of God is made clear in my need. And so, God's going to take me to these places so I can get to know Him. Know who He is in the areas where I don't know Him yet. Do you know somebody? All of us know people like this. You know someone, but you know them in certain situations or in certain ways. But then there are things that you've never seen or gotten to know about somebody. And this is, all of us are like this with each other. There's no one like this that you cannot say this is how they are. Right? Even spouses. You have areas where you don't actually know that person. Because, why? Because that area has never necessarily come up or been faced. Let's say, how do you know how someone will respond in extraordinary crisis? Well, you know, sometimes we hear about it, right? Some people respond heroically and some people respond in some cowardliness. Right? And you don't know. But how will you know how people will respond in extraordinary crisis? Well, you don't. And because you don't know, that crisis brings that out of you. Now, how do you know how your best friend will respond in extraordinary crisis? Well, you don't. You might kind of figure, well, they're kind of like this, but you don't really know. Likewise with God. Until the circumstance comes, I don't know Him in that circumstance yet. I don't know what He is like there. I may read the books, right, about Him. I certainly read my Bible. I can maybe read the theology. But I don't actually know Him in that area. And so He allows things to happen so that I would know Him. Now, question, does that mean that He has like thrown me out there and His arms are no longer beneath me? Or that somehow the situation, He let go of the situation and no longer has a grasp on it to see how things would go? His everlasting arms are always beneath me. So no, it does not mean that. it means that he actually has a firm hold on the circumstance, and he is allowing it for a season for me to get to know him. Now, will he be faithful? What will be the outcome? The outcome is that I will get to know him, that he will be faithful, that his character will be displayed, he will be true to his promises, and that all that he is will remain as it is, and nothing will be yielded, except I will get to know him. That's it right there. That's the whole story. I'll simply get to know him. Will he be true? Like, will he be true? Will he let destruction come? No, he won't let destruction come. He will be true. Will I be plucked out of his hand? No, I will not be plucked out of his hand. Will I be utterly cast down? No, I will not be utterly cast down. Will I fall? No, I will not fall. But what if I fail? He'll make me stand. Will it turn out well for me? Will I be okay? Yes, it will work together for good. But will I be okay? Will I be worse off than when I started? Will I be damaged? No, you will not be. The end of a thing is better than its beginning. When we get into these circumstances, the first step that we take is we grab a hold of God's promises and we meditate on them. Because God's promises reveal his character in the trial. And the trial can take on any kind of manifestation. But God's promises reveal his character in the trial. And when I realize that, then I'm starting to learn of him. That's what it means to take the yoke. It's a shawl that a student would put on. That was the yoke. That's why he says, take my yoke upon me and upon you and learn of me. The teacher would put a shawl on the student, and the student would start learning from the teacher. Jesus is saying, take this learning, take, if you will, the education that I'm giving you here, and learn. When that happens, the believer becomes very victorious. The fact that a person cannot trust God in a situation is not what he's angry about. What he's angry about is the enemy. He said, do not give place to the devil. What that means is don't give place to the devil to attack you. Because the place where I don't operate in the finished work is the place that the devil has to attack me. And if I give him that place, God becomes very angry. Not at me, but at the devil. And so he said in his wrath, right? That's, ever notice it seems almost like a strange kind of a statement? Let's look at it just for a minute. It looks like it's like a strange statement, a little bit, the way it's worded. And this is why, though. Okay? It says, for we which have believed do enter into rest. As he said, as I have sworn in my wrath, if they shall enter into my rest, all of the works were finished from the foundation of the world. Okay, the revised version said if they shall not enter into my rest, but either way, it's saying the same thing. The wrath of God is not for the believer, it's for Satan. The wrath of God is not even for the unbeliever. Christ died for the sins of the whole world. The wrath of God is for Satan. Even the time of Jacob's trouble is not the wrath of God against Israel, albeit discipline for Israel. Right? Really, the wrath of God is for Satan. What do you think, like, for example, I heard a great young preacher say this a while back, not too long, about Hagar. Um, Like, was God angry at Hagar? What do you think? I mean, she was the mother of Ishmael. Or was God angry with Abraham? Right? He took on Hagar. Or was God angry with Sarah? She encouraged Abraham to take Hagar. And then Abraham sent Hagar away. And God agreed, yet sent her. But she was like, it was hard. It was bad. So was God angry? No, He wasn't. No, God was restoring order in Abraham's life and Sarah's life. And then what happened with Hagar? And then she went to a spring. Right? This was a great thought. She went to a spring and then she got water from this, like that's where the water was. Right? And that's the word of God. That's where the water was. And so she goes to the spring and that's where Christ meets her. Was He angry with her? No, He wasn't. He gave her a promise. Was Hagar saved? This is a challenging one for believers. Was Hagar saved? I believe she was, yeah. She recognized Him as the Lord. Right? I think she was saved. Was Ishmael saved? That's an interesting one. Muslims come from Ishmael, don't they? Where did Islam come from? Ishmael? Muhammad. Islam didn't come from Ishmael. A race of people came from Ishmael. Islam came from Muhammad. Right? Ishmael may have been saved. I don't know. But Ishmael may have been saved, and there were promises given to Hagar regarding Ishmael. So he may have been saved. It was that his descendants, though, would be an issue for Israel. Right? But Islam didn't occur until Muhammad's day. Ishmael had nothing to do with Islam. He was the father of the Arab race. Much like Abraham was the father of the Jewish race, you know, the Hebrews, the Hebrew race. And so, you know, or I guess not so much Abraham was the father of both, really, right? But Jacob was the father of the Hebrew race. And likewise Ishmael, the father of the Arab race. So we have to kind of consider, like, what the finished work really means. And if I'm properly related to the finished work, things aren't going to be so drastic. I don't mean challenges. I just mean my thoughts regarding things will not necessarily be so drastic. Like, you know, if you ask a lot of Christians about, you know, was Ishmael saved, they would have a bit of a reaction and say, well, of course not. I mean, he was a wild man and stuff. Well, Ishmael himself wasn't. Ishmael himself had some promises. Anyway, anybody have any? You know what was interesting? The thought just came to me. Has anybody read the book Pastor's Wife? The Pastor's Wife by Sabina Wormbrand? It was an interesting book. In it, Sabina Wormbrand said, it was her account of her time in prison. She spent a few years imprisoned by the communists also, not long after her husband was imprisoned. But she wasn't in prison as long as he was, but still a matter of years. And she said something interesting. She said, prison was so difficult that there was no division of faith. But that was really interesting. But there, not just among the Christians, but among the Muslims and the Buddhists and the Christians and Hindus, because the communists hated all of them, and Jews, you know, the communists imprisoned all of them equally. Right? It wasn't just the Christians and the Jews that they were after. And she said it was so difficult that you loved the other because without that you'd never survive. Now that doesn't mean she gave up her faith for Islam, but she loved and they loved her and they survived. And so, you know, there's these areas like, yeah, we know that Islamic doctrine is not Christian doctrine. And as Christians, we do not agree with Islamic doctrine. Okay, but at the same time, like, these are not people who are insincere in their attitude toward God. They are people who are misled in their attitude toward God. Deceived. But not insincere. And this is, like, in some cases, you hear reports where it's actually very easy to win a Muslim in some ways, because they have a very great passion. Granted, it's misdirected and it's earthly and human and you know, not Christian, but it's a great passion. And so you can actually win a person like that. You know. A lot of those people are also amazing Christians once they get saved, right? Because those characteristics are then put in the right place, and you know, to the Savior. And boy, you can't move them.
We were listening to that confession by the Iranian girl on Pastor Shallow's. Well, we listened to Pastor Shallow's message, and then she came on while we were riding up to Pennsylvania last week, where she was talking about she prayed to God to reveal himself, and she was expecting to see Muhammad, and was really surprised to see Jesus, and she knew right away who he was, and like you say, it was very easy for her to follow that. I've heard that, I listened to that, or maybe we were even there, I don't even remember how long ago that was, because I think there was another woman that said had a similar story, but I remember that one from the CD. It was a fairly young girl.
Yeah, that was an amazing testimony. It sure was. We have to be careful with that. I think it's not you guys, but us Christians. You know, we have to be careful with that. Right? We don't win people by hating them. Right? But isn't that what happens? Right? I mean, Christians, I think, sometimes hate the Muslims because the Muslims, they see the ones, you know, they hear about on the news that blow themselves up and 15 other people, and it makes them angry and they hate the Muslims because of it. But it's interesting, though. I mean, when I taught in Baltimore City Community College, I taught a lot of Muslims. And I thought they were really interesting people. You know, I mean, on the one hand, you've got the ones who are radical Islam. You know, let's all go to war against everybody. But on the other hand, you have people who are very sincere and they're actually quite sweet. And they're almost simple. Like it's a simplicity to them. You know, there's like a kind simplicity to them. And or look at Peru's, like the people in Egypt on the streets, you know, how they respond. They actually remind me a lot of the people that I taught. Is, you know, there's not a great deal of animosity in their hearts toward people, except, you know, they don't want their government there, and they don't like Israel. But like, if you're talking to them, they don't have animosity in their heart toward you, because you're an American, because you're this, that, or the other. Right? They're not like that. A lot, most of them, I think, are not like that. So we have to be careful about that, that we don't get these cultural prejudices that are not actually of God. You know, we have to be careful about that. You know, Christians in general. Like, what happens if God sends somebody to the Muslim world? They can't have cultural prejudices. They're not going to want to win anybody to Christ. Right? But that happened. That's what happened with Jonah. Right? He had a cultural prejudice when God sent him, and he didn't want to go. And he didn't want to go precisely because he knew they would get saved. So we can't do that.